Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Warmer sea temperatures across large parts of the planet during the months of May and June are expected to have a similar effect on land temperatures in coming months, UN weather experts have said. The World Meteorological Organization forecast comes as the WMO confirmed that last April was as hot as the same month in 2016, the warmest April on record, even though there is no strong El Niño event now as there was then. Regions that are likely to be worst hit by the hotter conditions are those in the tropics and much of the northern hemisphere. The global warming trend is a contributory factor to this, according to the Weather Agency, which said that global temperatures in January, February, and March of this year were also the warmest or second warmest on record. 47.6 million people, that's the number in the Middle East and North Africa, who are unable to see a way of feeding themselves owing to the pandemic, the World Food Programme, WFP, said on Tuesday. In an alert linked to the COVID-19 crisis, the UN agency said that the economic impact will likely leave an additional 6.7 million people struggling for sufficient food. That assessment is based on the rising cost of staple foodstuffs in places like Sudan, where sorghum cost 14% more in March than a month earlier. In Syria, food costs are now at the highest price recorded since the start of the conflict in 2011, while in Yemen, food baskets in the capital Sana'a have recorded the highest monthly increase to date. Today, WFP helps more than 23 million people in the Middle East and North Africa. Two-thirds are in Yemen and Syria. The agency has also pre-positioned stocks of food and cash to provide at least 3 months of supplies or cash for priority operations. But it has warned that nearly 3.8 million children in 11 countries no longer receive WFP meals at school after they were closed to prevent the spread of infection. In 11 countries, which include Egypt, Tunisia, Iran, Libya, Sudan, and Lebanon, WFP has found new ways to support families, such as by providing take-home rations, delivering food to people's homes, and providing cash or vouchers. Finally, violence in northwestern Nigeria forced 23,000, mainly women and children, to flee to Niger last month, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, said on Tuesday. The agency has described relentless attacks by armed groups in Sokoto, Zamfara, and Katsina states, which have forced people into Niger's Maradi region, often with few belongings. The deadliest incident claimed 47 lives in Kankara, Danmusa, and Dusima in Katsina. Since the first influx of displaced people last April, the number seeking shelter has risen to more than 60,000. Victims have spoken of murders, kidnappings for ransom, and pillaging. An additional 19,000 Niger nationals have also been displaced inside their own country, said UNHCR, adding that the violence had been attributed to farmers and herders of different ethnic groups, as well as vigilantes. Despite COVID-19 border closures, those in need have been allowed to cross from Nigeria to Niger. UNHCR is now working closely with the Niger authorities to relocate at least 7,000 refugees to safety in villages away from the border where water, food, shelter, access to health and other basic assistance can be provided. This will also help ease the pressure on host communities in border areas where basic infrastructure and services are lacking, the UN Refugee Agency said. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Chris Hedges on Biden versus Trump and Bernie Sanders.
The ruling elites made it very clear that if Warren or Sanders was the Democratic Party nominee, they would vote for Donald Trump. This whole notion of the least worst only applies to us. They ensure that whatever candidate is in there protects the interests of the global oligarchic elites.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
At this cemetery in Sao Paulo, burials are happening on an industrial scale. Mourners are allowed 5 minutes at the gravesite before the next funeral rolls in. From the air, a sobering sight of what may be to come. 13,000 fresh graves have been prepared and they're still digging. Across Brazil, cases of infection are rising fast. Hospitals are undermanned and overstretched. Many suspected COVID-19 deaths are not added to the official tally.
Before he almost died from COVID-19, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson suggested Britain might just let the virus run until herd immunity was reached. What would that look like? We're about to find out as Brazil rockets towards utter disaster. Like most countries, the Brazilian economy has crashed faster and further than the Great Depression of the 1930s. Like the United States, their president is encouraging rebellion against his own government's virus protection program. Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro famously said of the coming wave of coronavirus deaths, "So what?" With his partisan base in a country of extreme wealth disparity, Brazil is a mirror of the United States. Brazil had the ninth largest economy in the world and at least 211 million people. All sorts of raw materials and agricultural products come from Brazil, including the soy underlying meat and poultry production in the United States, Europe, and beyond. What happens in Brazil doesn't stay there. Anyone with a shred of consciousness for the human project should fear what is happening in Brazil. In these very early days of the Brazilian virus onslaught, we have a report direct from Sao Paulo. Gustavo Ribeiro, editor of the Brazilian Report, gives his views. Then we talk with Tenny Naumer, an American experienced in health and finance who lived in Brazil for 14 years. Tenny is also a news hound whose tips inspired several Radio EcoShock shows. I'm Alex Smith. Let's go to our first interview.
Radio EcoShock.
For a report on the pandemic in Brazil, we go to Gustavo Ribeiro, founder and editor-in-chief of the Brazilian Report, from Sao Paulo. Gustavo, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Are most shops and restaurants closed in Rio and Sao Paulo?
Yes, both states are under quarantine rules since late in March, and bars and restaurants can only work on a delivery basis. All non-essential shops are closed, and only healthcare facilities and civil construction and drugstores, this kind of services that the government has deemed as essential, can operate normally right now.
Are people in the streets trying to keep social distancing, and are many wearing masks?
Masks are becoming mandatory in several parts of the country right now. The government of São Paulo and Rio have enacted laws that first they tried to make it mandatory in public transport, and now you cannot go on the streets without wearing one, or else you may be fined. And depending on your behavior, you could even be arrested for what they call a reckless behavior, again, to the detriment of public health. But in terms of social distancing, no, not so much. When you go to supermarkets, you see people passing right next to each other, just in complete disregard with the recommendations of the WHO or even the health ministry.
When was the first COVID-19 case discovered in Brazil, and is the disease spreading rapidly?
COVID-19 arrived in Brazil late in February, February 26th. Although many experts suggest that the virus arrived to Brazil much sooner than that, we just don't know yet. There have been some conflicting reports about who would actually be patient one. What we do know is that the virus was brought to Brazil by wealthy people who were traveling to Europe. So when scientists mapped the genome of the coronavirus in Brazil, they found much more similarities with strains they found in Italy than those in China, which suggests that most of the first people that were diagnosed in Brazil actually had been to Milan or Rome just days prior to being diagnosed. And the virus is spreading really quickly in Brazil. We have several metropolitan areas with hospitals reaching their ICU capacity. Although it is complicated to talk about figures in Brazil because underreporting is massive. We have many studies claiming that the real figures could be from 5 to 15 times higher than the actual figures, and that the real number of people infected by the coronavirus in Brazil could be 1.6 to 2 million people right now.
Gustavo, please tell us about the outbreak in Manaus, the state capital of Amazonas.
Yes, Manaus is the biggest Amazonian city, and in the north part of the country, sanitation conditions are less than ideal, and it was a region where social distancing was not respected. It quickly became the state with the highest numbers of deaths and infections per million. It was the first city to declare a collapse of its healthcare system, and even funerary companies were at full capacity because the number of burials that were registered in Manaus were figures that were never seen before. Authorities had to start digging common graves, collective graves, to deal with the sheer amount of bodies that were coming.
Is the Brazilian government protecting the health of indigenous people?
No. It is important to understand that even in normal circumstances, the health conditions in indigenous communities are pretty precarious because they live in a lot of areas that are isolated. So if you get sick, you have to get on the boat and have a boat ride for hours, sometimes more than a day, in order to get to a city with proper health care. For instance, there are very few cities that have ICU beds in the Amazon region. So that's already a problem under normal circumstances. Now we have almost a little over 80,000 indigenous peoples that are considered to be extremely vulnerable. And the fact that many of these communities have not developed the antibodies that urban populations have make them all the more vulnerable to the coronavirus. And it's also important to realize that Jair Bolsonaro, even before becoming president, he has always gone against any policies to protect indigenous people. He said that indigenous people must be forcefully integrated to Western society, and that the government should not give them an inch of land more than they already have.
And then we have Brazil's almost lawless shanty towns, the favelas, and they get little government aid in the best of times. What is the risk of COVID-19 if it reaches the millions of people living there?
Well, Brazilian favelas could be breeding grounds for the coronavirus because these are areas that are very poorly urbanized. Sanitation conditions are not very good, and they are extremely densely populated. In São Paulo, wealthy neighborhoods sometimes have rates of 2% of households with more than two people per room. When you go to favelas, that rate goes to 44, 50, 60%. So social distancing is nearly impossible in some communities. And you have families living together with elderly people or children, all with sometimes four, five, six people in a one-room house. So it could really spread quickly in those communities. And the problem is these communities have very little access to healthcare services. So maybe the spread is already going very fast. We're just not fully aware of the extent of the problem.
And it's not like people there are separated from the people of Rio or Sao Paulo, because I've been to the favelas. It was a very long time ago. But it seemed to me that so many people there worked down in the city, went to people's homes as servants and as landscapers and whatever, providing basic services, so that if there's illness in the shanty towns, there will be illness again back in the big cities. It can't be separated.
Yes, no, you're totally right. In Rio, the urban dynamic, it means that wealthy communities are very close to poor ones. And we are seeing now, because the fact that, for instance, they have a very informal economy, and people in the favelas, usually they don't live paycheck to paycheck, they live day to day. So they have to go out and get the earnings on that day, and they will have to do that every single day. So social distancing in those communities are also very reduced because people just cannot afford to stay home. And the government has not provided enough financial support to these communities in order to allow them to stay home. And we have seen, for instance, in Rio, Copacabana, which is a neighborhood with a high rate of elderly people, it was the number one place in terms of COVID-19 deaths. And that has quickly changed to Campo Grande, a peripheral community in Rio, where social isolation rates are the lowest in the city. It is where a place where people just have to go out and have to make ends meet every single day.
The president of Brazil has sometimes been called the Donald Trump of South America, and he has said publicly there is little he can do. And like Trump, Jair Bolsonaro contradicted his own health authorities and encouraged people to get back to life as normal. He walks about without a mask, still shakes hands apparently. Talk to us about the mixed messages coming from the federal government.
Since the start of the pandemic, the Brazilian Health Ministry has followed WHO recommendations. And since the start of the pandemic, Jair Bolsonaro has been the poster boy for COVID-19 denialism. So he has undermined the authority of his health minister time and again. Late in April, he fired his health minister. So we have, for 3 weeks, a health minister that just seems lost, that has not yet shown what he's there for, has not yet presented people with a plan to tackle this pandemic. The only noteworthy thing he has done so far is to admit that Brazil is flying blind amid this pandemic. And like you said, Bolsonaro has created gatherings on the street. He has incited supporters to go out and protest against stay-home rules. And he has been a major force of maybe helping this pandemic be much worse. For instance, on the Brazilian Report, we published a study that shows that the president's speeches, his public addresses, are very much linked to drops in social isolation rates. So the political pressure that President Bolsonaro has put in order to discredit experts, discredit state governors that try to enforce quarantines, has worked on the president's behalf and has essentially dropped public support for social isolation.
And what is the situation for COVID-19 testing in Brazil?
Brazil has tested very little. And for instance, the United States are by no means a world standard for COVID-19 tests, but the U.S. had tested 10 times more per million people than Brazil. So, like I said, even the health minister will be the first one to admit that Brazil just doesn't know how many people are infected, how many people have actually died of COVID-19, because in Brazil we have a surge of deaths by undetermined causes. We have a big spike in cases of acute respiratory distress syndrome. The signs are all over the place that the COVID-19 problem is much worse in Brazil. We just don't know because we don't test enough.
On a side note, I watched the top Rio team play Sao Paulo at Maracana Stadium, and obviously football in Brazil, which North Americans call soccer, it's close to religion. It was crazy times, giant flags, giant crowds. What will happen to the football season?
The football season is upended. The Brazilian football season starts with state championships, and these have been interrupted. There are calls that we should go back. It is a premature move, but many teams are already midway through May resuming practices, but we still don't know when a football match will be played again in Brazil. We don't know how the Brazilian league which is a 38-fixture tournament, is going to play out, if it's going to have the same format. If, for instance, Brazil will adapt its sports calendar, because in Brazil we use a year calendar. So the 2020 season, for instance, it starts in January and it ends in December. Maybe Brazil adapt to the Northern Hemisphere and start on what would be the Northern Hemisphere fall and then finish by the beginning of summer. But it's still very much upended. Nobody knows what is going on, and nobody knows, actually, if people will want to go to a stadium in the near future. And that's the key thing, because revenue will go down. And in Brazil, we have most clubs are in dire financial straits, but the big ones, they can manage. They have a lot of political support, and they can manage to renegotiate that and renegotiate TV deals and try to make it work. The problem here is that we have hundreds of small teams that depend on these state championships I talked about that are very small tournaments, and maybe a lot of them would just go bankrupt. And we're going to have a completely different football landscape in 2021 and so on.
In early 2020, Brazil had the ninth largest gross domestic product in the world. And now industrial production has crashed, as it has in most other countries. But money has fled the Brazilian stock market and billions of dollars just left the country. What signs do you see of the economic hit from this pandemic?
It's going to be a long depression. And the problem is, we are just off the worst recession in the century, which happened between 2016 and 2017. So now it would seem that we were starting to pick up economic activity again, and then, boom, the pandemic hits us. So it's going to be a long depression because, for instance, Brazilian industry now is at a point where it is 20% below 2014 levels. Brazilian is undergoing a massive deindustrialization process. We are already starting to see massive layoffs, and some estimates have that Brazil's unemployment rate could go up to 30-40% of the workforce. So that would mean that we would go from the current 12-13 million people out of a job to about 40-45 million people out of a job. And in a country where purchasing power has deteriorated a lot over the past 6-7 years, that could mean social unrest, that could be very dangerous. And one thing is for sure, inequality will go up and poverty rates will go off the charts in at least the near future.
And what about the tourism industry and Rio's famous restaurants?
The tourism industry is practically in a halt right now. Almost all flights in Brazil are grounded, and people just don't have faith that the economy will be anywhere in an acceptable level. So family consumption is going down. People are just reducing their spending to the bare minimum, to their core needs, and tourism is by no means one of those needs. So it will be a hard future for the tourism industry. For instance, aviation companies, they are depending on the government bailout to avoid bankruptcy. We're going to see a hotel occupancy rates plummeting. And the problem is the tourism industry in Brazil depends on a very fragile ecosystem of local players and small players. And these people are going to have to face economic hardship at least for 1 to 2 years, because tourism in Brazil is mostly domestic. We don't get that many tourists from abroad. So tourism in Brazil, for instance, brings around 7 to 8 million people per year. And that's about as much or even fewer people than the Eiffel Tower alone. So it's already a feeble industry that depends almost solely on domestic travel. And with unemployment rates going up, with revenue going down, I just don't see people traveling as much or spending as much on trips as they would before.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
From an outside perspective, Gustavo Ribeiro, it appears parts of Brazil are difficult to govern in the best of times. Maybe Bolsonaro is right. There's really very little the government can do to reduce the death toll. And will the population cooperate? What are your thoughts?
I think there is a lot that the government can do and that the government is not doing. For instance, trying to offer people mechanisms for them to stay at home. We have seen a lack of political coordination with Congress in order to pass economic bills that would help the country weather the crisis. Or even if the president was not just asking people to go out and to expose themselves to COVID-19, maybe that would already be a major help. So the problem is not necessarily what the government is not doing. The problem is also how the government actively is making the situation worse. And yes, there are many places in Brazil that are difficult to govern. Brazil is a very heterogeneous country, and you cannot just implement one single measure or one single strategy everywhere. And I'm sure you in the U.S. can relate to that because you have New York is not the same as Wyoming and so on. So in Brazil, we have also states that are extremely different from one another. That being said, most governors are trying to work together, are trying to exchange knowledge. And we just don't see the federal government stepping in and coordinating this effort, because the federal government has the lion's share of tax revenue. It could try at least to make cooperation between states in terms of sharing healthcare beds, in terms of sharing revenue with one another, and that the government is not even trying to be a leader in this crisis. So I would say that Bolsonaro's approach to COVID-19, to put it mildly, has been a disaster.
And now in the international press, aerial photos are circulating of mass graves being prepared outside several Brazilian cities. Are there any estimates, official or unofficial, of the expected death toll in Brazil over the next few months?
Well, we could be heading for tens or even hundreds of thousands of deaths. But like I said, testing is so feeble in Brazil right now that we just cannot estimate what is going on. If we take, for instance, Brazil has yet to reach 10,000 deaths, confirmed deaths. And we know that the numbers are much higher than that. If, for instance, some estimates that the real numbers are 15 times higher than the official figures, we could already have had 150,000 to 200,000 deaths without even knowing that those were caused by the coronavirus. So things are going to get much uglier, because even the government admits that the peak of the outbreak in Brazil will come between May and June. So we have to brace ourselves for the worst 60-day stretch. And this is precisely at the moment when people are less inclined to stay home and they're more eager to get back to some kind of normalcy.
And as this pandemic develops, the Brazilian government has been racked with turmoil and firings and resignations, as you mentioned. Could this emergency destabilize the government? And is there a possibility the military could step in to rescue the situation?
Well, the military has been an integral part of the Bolsonaro administration. There are roughly 3,000 military officers in the executive branch right now named by this administration. They have a lot of cabinet members. It's the first democratically elected president to have as many military officers in the cabinet. In Brazil, we know we have a history of military coups. There were a lot of successful ones and a lot of attempted ones over the 20th century. So that has always been a shadow lurking around in Brazil. But as far as our sources are telling us, our sources within the military's top breath, they would not engage in this kind of reckless adventure of trying to topple a democratic government. But the mere fact that they are on the president's corner has prevented other political forces from charging towards the president. They are right now over 30 impeachment requests sitting at the desk of House Speaker, of the Brazilian House Speaker, and he has said that there is no interest in pulling such a move right now, and we don't have yet the political ingredients for maybe going after Bolsonaro right now, because even if he is the least popular Brazilian leader after 16 months in office, he still has a very solid core of supporters of 28 to 30%. And social isolation, which he is so against, is actually working on his favor because we don't have people on the streets protesting against the government. Pretty much everyone who is against the government is staying home. So that's working on Bolsonaro's favor.
Gustavo, what is it like personally to be riding out a pandemic in Sao Paulo?
It's pretty nerve-wracking at times. We are seeing the president's supporters going after the press. Just on May 3rd, we saw two reporters being beaten down by the president's backers during an anti-quarantine demonstration. We have seen an enormous amount of misinformation circulating and people just not knowing who to trust. I hope that this pandemic will help the press regain public trust, because information in this case is going to save lives, and the lack of good information may cost a lot of lives. So I just hope that the Brazilian public will start appreciating the job that reporters are doing, putting themselves out there and putting themselves sometimes at risk in order to give them updated and clear information about the pandemic. Even if we're still learning things about COVID-19.
As we wrap up here, tell us about the Brazilian report and where our listeners can find it.
Well, the Brazilian Report is an independent media outlet that tries to explain Brazil to foreign audiences. So we write about politics, economics, and society. You can find the Brazilian Report on brazilian.report. We also have a weekly podcast that is on every single podcast aggregator, and you can listen to us speaking about the ins and outs of Brazilian politics. And well, like we like to say, you never get bored in Brazil. There's always a new crisis to cover.
From Sao Paulo, we have been speaking with Gustavo Ribeiro, founder and editor-in-chief of the Brazilian Report. And I want to thank you for such a clear report from your country. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. And whenever you need information from Brazil, we're always here.
We will be back to you. I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Now, in hindsight, we can see the toxic mix of failing to provide public health care, a broken safety net, billionaires sucking wealth away from the growing underclass, and a corrupt political system. Am I talking about Brazil or the United States? Be honest, if anyone told you the United States would have millions of cases of a new virus and more deaths than any other country, would you have believed that? But we do not know the prognosis for countries with hundreds of millions of people in absolute poverty, the places with almost no infrastructure, weak government, low education, slight health care, and perhaps a reliance on religion or magic. How will the COVID-19 pandemic develop in Africa, India, or Indonesia? Brazil may give us a preview. Why is Brazil ramping up as the next great COVID-19 disaster? You would have to know the country as Tani Naumer does. She lived in Brazil 14 years before returning to the United States. Tani is a professional translator in Portuguese, but I've been following her climate blog for years, and some of the stories you've heard on Radio EcoShock were inspired by her work. She has one of those rare eyes for important signals in a whole world of information. From Illinois, Tani Naumer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you for asking me to be on.
It must be difficult to see a country that you love approaching such a deadly disaster.
Oh, yeah, it really is. I have so many friends there, and they're not prepared. Their healthcare system must already be completely overwhelmed. I mean, I lived in a city in the interior that's out in the country, of the state of Bahia, and that was a municipality with a good 400,000 people. I was the only American. But I'm well acquainted with their healthcare system there. And the national healthcare system is called SUS. And basically, those are small clinics that give inoculations and pregnancy tests. But they also do a lot with birth control and giving out free birth control, and also antiviral medication for HIV-positive people. So that's one of the reasons that Brazil has a low rate of HIV death or infections, AIDS deaths or infections. They're very good about promoting condoms. But be that as it may, it's in no way capable of handling this crisis. The regular hospitals, the private ones, you largely have to pay up front to get into them. So that precludes everybody. And the doctors are not well trained either. They don't actually go to pre-med. They go straight from high school into medical school. There are some good ones, but generally they go outside the country to get more training, either to the United States or to the UK in general. So the situation there, they've hit over 600 deaths per day. People are buried within 24 hours. They're supposed to be buried. It's just going to be a mess because they have the same situation that we have here with a president who is uneducated in science and doesn't believe a lot of things that he should be believing, and he's an authoritarian, and he's got a following of people that are much like we have the Trump following here in the United States, and it's just a mess. So I don't know what's going to happen there. It's not going to be good.
Yes, after saying the coronavirus was just a little flu, that was in March, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro told a press conference that, quote, Brazilians don't catch anything. They already have the antibodies to keep it from spreading, end quote. And that sounds like the kind of magical thinking we have heard in America from Trump. Is the president in Brazil as powerful and influential as the American president?
In some ways, he may be more so. In other ways, not. The governors there in Brazil are doing what they can to protect their own people. But the corruption in Brazil is extreme. I couldn't even get a driver's license without the lady behind the desk looking at me, trying to figure out how she could give me a signal to give her something. It's so extreme there let's just go back to the coronavirus. They're not going to have supplies. They're not going to have testing. They're not going to have care. It's going to be bad. And Jair Bolsonaro, he is just kind of nutty, and he has a fanatical following, and the military kind of props him up. I've even heard that the military is actually in charge of day-to-day things, but I don't know. And also, he's being investigated. His family is being investigated for the murder of his family's connections are being investigated for the murder of the Rio City Council woman, Marielle Franco. And apparently the paramilitary police, ex-police officers and ex-army have really risen in the years since I lived there, and they now control large neighborhoods like a mafia. And so the crime, the legal structure is failing. The judges, when you can just have somebody murdered for a couple hundred dollars, a judge is not going to render an adverse decision, and a prosecutor has to go around with bodyguards. The judges, if they go after these gangs, they have to go around with bodyguards, which are usually killed. And it's just it's worse than Italy. It's far worse than Italy. So the level in the city is, it's just really bad. The coronavirus thing is gonna devastate Brazil. I don't see any other outcome. They were going to kick out the Cuban doctors who had come in to help. They actually have pretty good training. I think maybe they didn't finally, but also the social distancing, people aren't practicing it. Most the poor there have, they're lucky if they have a third grade education. So they don't have science. They don't know about germs. They don't know about particles traveling in air. They have no idea of microscopy and how things can be very tiny and get them. And that all plays a part in it. Now that everybody's staying home and they have these large families, it's going to spread. It's just a very, I don't have any good news about Brazil.
Well, we may see a situation similar to what happened in Wuhan, China, where whole families pretty well passed away together in their houses. But, I dread those sorts of scenes. Now, according to a recent article in the British medical journal, The Lancet, quote, a recent study by Imperial College UK, which analyzed the active transmission rate of COVID-19 in 48 countries, showed that Brazil is the country with the highest rate of transmission. So that's another reason that I see to be terribly worried about news coming from Brazil, say in July or August, when it's winter in the southern hemisphere and even the common flu tends to spread during that time. But maybe I'm just being paranoid.
No, because those numbers in the report you mentioned are based on rather low testing. So you can imagine if there were more testing, what those numbers would actually say, the infection rate would be much higher. Again, that there is not going to be any care for the poor. I mean, this system as it is now, if they needed help with something, they might wait months to get an appointment. When I was there, for example, even I would have to stand on the street in line to get into the doctor's office and take a number because it was you couldn't call up and make an appointment. You had to go and physically stand there, even if you were sick, and get a number in line. It's really bad. It's going to be really bad, and it's going to be like the showcase for how bad things can be. And there's no way to get the testing in there. The rich people are going to try to get out and probably try to fly into Miami, where all the rich Brazilians with their corrupt money have bought apartments. Yeah, they will flee the country or they will have some way of protecting themselves by isolating themselves. They might now have to do their own dishes for a change and prepare their own food. But yeah, the rich are going to make out and the rest of the country is going to, I have to wonder how this will affect the world's economy, too, because Brazil is not an insignificant supplier of raw materials around the world, things like that, and that will all be affected as well. Their credit rating has now been downrated. That's just the beginning. The currency is going down daily. I think it's gone down about 25% in the last 3 months. It's just not good, and I really am afraid for my friends there.
It's not a secret what's going on. In a speech at the Supreme Court, President Bolsonaro and his finance minister warned the economy would go into total collapse if the country was not reopened immediately. And the stock market has crashed. The financial system looks shaky. Money is fleeing the country. And I wonder if this is a reality that the country does need to reopen or people are going to starve. Or is this something being pushed by the elite in order to keep their own money safe? I don't know.
I don't think reopening the country or not reopening it is at this point, with no testing and no healthcare system functioning adequately, one wonders whether it will even matter because of the lack of social distancing. And I think it's just going to tear right through Brazil, and we're going to see what happens. I mean, when you look at the meatpacking plants in the States where they want to, they're forcing them to reopen when they've got hundreds of known cases and everybody knows they're going to get exposed to it. Brazilians, on the other hand, they can't stay. The rich people are not going to ask the maids to come back and the domestic ladies at work, and they're not going to ask them to come back in the house unless they're stupid. Because, again, the education there, there's no great emphasis on science or bacteria and that kind of thing. But it's just like in this country, you're going to send your kids to school even if they reopen? Are you going to do that as a parent? No, absolutely not. So I don't think the economy is going to be helped by reopening or hindered. I think it's just going to have to, the whole thing's going to have to run its course. It's like too late. It's way too late.
And is there a safety net for the majority of people in Brazil? Is hunger or even famine a possibility there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure it is. Because when Lula became president, they had Bolsa Família, which was a monthly stipend, and a lot of people came up, and it was very, very helpful. But they've had a program of austerity, which helps no one, and it certainly didn't help the economy. And people are already living on the edge. Yes, hunger, yes. At the grocery stores, people would leave food. They would donate, and that would be handed out. And that all disappeared. That whole infrastructure disappeared when Lula came in and started Bolsa Família. And so I don't know if that was reintroduced by people willing to help. But in general, the rich don't give to charities because of corruption, and a lot of the money disappears. So in general, they don't have all these charities helping people. They do have some, of course, but in general, not like here, because the money just disappears. So no one trusts to give to a charity. They'll give a package of food, but still, you know, it's like in a time like this, they're going to be each to his own, like hunkering down and trying to limit, donations to family members and things like that. And I don't know what they're going to do in the cities where it's somehow easier out in the country, I think. But a place like São Paulo of 20 million people, I just don't have anything. There's just no bright spot here.
I know the wealthy hope this pandemic will hit the poor and maybe even reduce them in their sort of fascist daydreams. But top military generals, senators, and confidants of the president have come down with the sickness too. Do you think the suffering will be general, or as you say, the rich will just get out and the poor will die off in greater numbers? Any ideas on that line?
I don't know about the poor or the rich wanting the poor to die off because they find them very useful. But I think in the way it's spreading now in Brazil with limited testing, I think it's just going to spread through the whole country. I don't see how people can avoid it. Rich or poor, I don't see how anyone can avoid being exposed to this. They might get an exposure, infection rate of 80 to 90%. I just don't see how people can avoid it at this point. It's really going to just flood through the country.
Well, this is a nightmare. I live in a Canadian village right on the border with the United States, and our government has closed that border to all but essential traffic.
Good.
Well, America is the most infected country in the world. We're nervous, so I bet Brazil's neighbors must be worried to see that colossus falling to an unstoppable disease.
None of those neighbors have medical systems like we think of them here in the north. None of those countries have that. So they're all going to be quite worried. I haven't really looked at what the other countries are doing, but of course in Venezuela there is no medical system that functions anymore. I have a friend there that can't even get cheap blood pressure medication. Anyway, those countries are going to be hit hard too, but they might be able to, do some isolation and social distancing. I don't know. But in Brazil, it's just impossible now. yeah, one of my daughter's best friends there. We collected money to send to him. We transferred money to him so he could pay his rent because he wasn't working. And now he's come down with the virus, too, and he was social distancing.
That's pretty tough. So if the bodies begin to pile up and collapse sadly arrives, will the military step in again to rescue Brazil?
Oh, Lord. They might do something. I mean, Brazilians are used to things like this. It's not unknown to them. Like, we wouldn't expect our military to do something like that. But there, and, you know, they're having these protests, and the protesters are yelling, you know, bring back the military, because they've obviously forgotten what 20 years of a military dictatorship was like, because it happened so long ago. I think it ended in, what, 1986 or something, in the 80s anyway. And so they've long forgotten how bad that was and what an economic mess. There's not one single country that's ever had a military dictatorship that wasn't an economic disaster. So I don't know why they would think that would be any different. But they've just, it's like in this country, people have forgotten how things used to be, and they call for things that are ridiculous. So if the military steps in, I think it may create some order. But note that the military is not very far distant from the ex-police militias that are all over the country. I mean, it would be equivalent to letting those people have totally free reign. It would be, oh my, I don't even want to think about it.
Well, now you're back in the United States, but you're not really that much safer from this outbreak. What is happening in Illinois and with people you know there?
We're quite lucky in Illinois because we actually have a Democrat governor, Governor J.B. Pritzker, who, although Chicago's had a terrible outbreak, he's doing everything in his power to get equipment, PPE, and everything that he can do is being done. So I'm extremely grateful to live in the state of Illinois, because I was in Texas, which is opening up. I spent 3 years in Texas, and down there, they did not expand Medicaid under the ACA Obamacare plan. So their medical care for the poor covers only children and pregnant women. The rest better go and die quickly if you get sick. And here in Illinois, at least Medicaid was expanded. We can't bear much more down here. I'm in the south part of the state, the extreme southern part, and we don't really have a lot of doctors here, so we have to keep this down, because any further increase now will overwhelm the system. And I've been very lucky, because I've been in the hospital three times in the last 2 months with a kidney stone problem, and fortunately they let me in, because they had stopped all non-essential services. So we're doing good down here. So far, so good. I'm in a great state, but next door in Missouri, we got a crazy Republican who's just letting everybody do everything. I wish they had closed the Mississippi River bridges to Missouri and Iowa. Same thing, crazy people. But so far, so good in Illinois.
Hey, Teddy, on a personal note, I always wondered how you managed to spot the most essential climate news and the new science, and you published it at your blog at climatechangepsychology.blogspot.com. How do you stay so informed? Do you have any tips for us?
Well, I did work as a technical editor for Elsevier Science Publishers for 6.5 years on analytical chemistry, academic journals, and brain research. And I did start out in chemistry at university. And I kind of was born with a nose for more serious information rather than junk. And then I've been in some Google groups with some top climate scientists, to my great honor. And so I think the more you read, the more you can develop a nose for what's actually good, what's serious, and what's important. Because I had to, you know, there's almost 9,000 articles now on that blog. It's a pretty good database. I haven't had time in the last year or two to do what I once did with it, but after you go through that much information, you get a bit of an idea of, I had to go through 2 or 3 times that many articles just to pick them out. You do get a sort of a nose for it. All I can say is read, learn,
Yes, so much new is happening in this world that we all need to be sort of permanently in school. I ask listeners to spend about an hour a day just trying to learn about climate and now about this disease, and to stay tuned to other countries, because we get so sucked into everything in America is about the United States, everything in Canada is about Canada, and the UK about UK. And yet we are in a global society, and this pandemic, I think, has taught us that if something pops up in Wuhan, China, or in Milan, Italy, you need to know.
Yeah, you do. And I lived in Europe for a total of 9 years, so I have a little bit of a broader viewpoint. And then being in South America for 14 years, so I have a little bit broader perspective than I otherwise would have. Every little bit of knowledge helps. I mean, I know people who've never been out of Southern Illinois, and they don't want to know about any of this stuff, and it upsets them to know about it. And you can't talk to these people. They get upset, and they don't want to be your friend anymore, basically. So I don't know. It's just I think books will be written on this subject. What is the psychology of people who can actually see the truth and understand it, and those who can look at the truth and say it's not the truth? I don't know how that works in the human mind.
I am seeing some blistering new research on heat levels coming to countries around the world, and some extremes beyond human endurance have already appeared in many places, including in the southern U.S. Do you think, and this is sort of a rhetorical question, but do you think climate impacts will take a holiday while we humans are stressed out about this pandemic and about the economic depression and about feeding ourselves and about failed politics and about what Trump said yesterday?
Oh, no. Summer's coming, and I live in southern Illinois, which used to have winter, and we don't really have snow anymore, and we have armadillos.
No, that's Texas stuff, armadillos.
And the trees are dying. And I saw, and they've been dying for the last several years. We had a heat dome in 2012 where we had 105 to 113 degree Fahrenheit for a couple of weeks. And the trees literally just like exploded and fell over and died. And the trees over, it's like, I saw a good illustration of this. Our trees here, at least, are like similar to what happens to the coral reef. You know, the heat comes and it damages them, some of it dies. It comes and damages, some dies. And that's what's happening with the trees in southern Illinois. They're dying. They're falling over. It's like pickup sticks out here. And I mention it to people, and they don't see it. And they get upset and don't want to talk to me anymore. And we're going to have a bad summer. This summer, the jet stream is completely gone to lunch and not coming back for 100,000 years. And it's going to let all that heat in, just like they're having in California right now. Over in Africa, people don't talk much about Africa because that continent is not well examined. But they're having very high temperatures right now on the northern edge of their rainforest. India is having, you know, close to 50 degrees centigrade. It's bad, and it's not going to give us a pass this summer.
Returning now to our focus on Brazil, Tenny Naumer, what are your best hopes for that country for the time when this virus is finally beaten back?
Wow. I think our best hope is what we hope for all countries, and that is that people will have learned that they need to help each other, and we have to do this together and not apart, and we have to depend on each other and appreciate each other more, despite our various differences.
Good one. So as we wrap up here, is there anything else you'd like to talk about or to tell our listeners?
No, just keep up the good fight is all I can think of saying. We have to do it. Can't give up.
All right. Now, I'd like to get back to you at another time and talk to you more about the Amazonian rainforest and the destruction that's happening there and how important that is to the lungs, to the planet. We could spend hours on that, but right now, let's say from Illinois, we've been speaking with longtime Brazilian resident Tenny Naumer. Find links to this story in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Tenny, it was great to finally meet you.
You too, Alex. I've listened to your program many times.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Next week, I'm going to try to break through the spell of COVID to hear other harsh news we cannot avoid. I specialize in interviewing scientists about extreme heat. I have a small booklet of interview transcripts in the works, by the way. Scientific and medical guests explain how high heat threatens the human body. Every year, extreme heat kills millions of people directly and damages the natural world in ways we seldom see. In 2020, it is an awful race to see which will kill more people this year, the new coronavirus or weather extremes forced by climate change. It looks like both will happen at the same time, whether we want it or not.
Why is it taking so long? Can you explain it to me? Nobody can explain it to me. And don't tell me about all those damn winds again. Of the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere get all mixed up and overlap. I don't want to hear about that anymore. All I want to know is, if everybody was so smart, why didn't they know what would happen?
It did.
Well, I can't take it. Oh, yes, I can take it. But it's unfair. It's unfair because I didn't do anything. And nobody I know did anything.
There are many reasons to expect heat waves and wildfires this summer in the Northern Hemisphere. With far less air pollution to dim the sun, we may experience heat waves that kill off crops and people. That could add to the developing food crisis during the pandemic, which I have covered in recent shows, meaning some products disappear from store shelves in wealthy countries, and millions go into hunger, including the famine predictions I covered in last week's show. Next week, we will hear from two scientists with stark new conclusions about the coming heat. There are limits to what plants can stand before they die off. There are limits to the heat and humidity the human body can survive. We are already breaching those limits now and then, but in the coming decades, scientists say, heavily populated parts of Earth will become uninhabitable. Then comes great migrations not seen in history. Heat beyond normal experience is just as hard to imagine as the huge impacts of COVID-19. We are just at the start of both. I understand how painful this information can be. Sometimes I limp away after an interview or producing a show like this one. I head out into the garden or I talk to my chickens. Inside, I want to run away, maybe to a happier time in the past or some remote part of nature. But for you and I, there is a code. It is less painful to pursue the truth than to avoid it. We need to make big changes in our personal lives, as a society, and as a species. I believe there is a way toward a better future. It's not back, it's towards a better future. But only through the courageous search for reality and followed by right action by all of us. It sounds naive, but that is all we have. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock. Please tune in again next week and show someone you care this week.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Chris Hedges on Biden versus Trump and Bernie Sanders. In this interview on activism, Munich, Chris Hedges also comments on Noam Chomsky's endorsement of Biden, the mistakes of the Sanders campaign, corporate media, the power of the U.S. arms industry, the rise of fascism, and the bipartisan efforts to expand global trade that impoverishes working people. Chris Hedges is a columnist, award-winning journalist, and war reporter, a New York Times best-selling author, a professor in the college degree program offered to New Jersey State prisoners by Rutgers University, and an ordained Presbyterian minister. Activism Munich is a nonprofit and independent online media portal in both German and English. Zen Raza founded Activism in 2013 and is the senior editor. Zen Raza's questions reflect the view of the U.S. from a European perspective. And for the benefit of a European audience, he begins by asking Chris Hedges about his extraordinary past and present under Corona. Zen Raza.
Thank you guys for tuning in, and welcome to another episode of The Source, where we interview investigative journalists, former insiders, or whistleblowers. My name is Zen Raza, and today I'll be talking to best-selling author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges. Chris's latest book is called America, The Farewell Tour. Chris, thank you so much for your time.
Sure.
You just told me off camera that you're based in Princeton, New Jersey. Could you talk about how the general atmosphere is there at the moment during COVID-19 and also how you are holding up personally at this time?
Well, since I'm writing a book and since I just got fired from Truthdig along with the rest of the staff for going on strike, it doesn't actually affect my life, my work life personally, because this is what I would be doing every day. I have a deadline in November. Princeton, which is a university town, is taking the COVID-19 very seriously, but anecdotally, it's clear that the United States is in chaos in terms of their inability to handle the virus, their lack of preparedness, their lack of coordination. It's just a disaster. I have had three close friends who have had COVID-19. One, Joe Sacco, the great cartoonist, was quite ill. Thankfully, he's much better. They were never tested. One of them was a doctor. They were never tested. It's clear that the priority among the ruling elites in the United States is to reopen the economy no matter what, which means that the virus will just come in wave after wave, cluster after cluster. The global capitalists are quite prepared to sacrifice unnecessarily large numbers of people in order to get the economy moving again. It's really appalling. The reaction by the Congress and the ruling political elites has been to throw a $1,500 check at people. Most people haven't even gotten it. It prolong unemployment benefits by a couple months. Again, the systems crash. People who have applied for unemployment benefits haven't gotten it. And then just leave them hanging, while at the same time bailing out the cruise industry and the airline industry. And it's just exposes the internal rot, the political rot, the infrastructure rot within the United States that many of us, including myself, have been writing about for a long time.
I want to dive into COVID-19 and other issues later on this interview. So for our European viewers that do not know about your personal journey, I want to talk about this at this time. You spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, the Balkans. All in all, you've reported in more than 50 countries for mainstream outlets, including the New York Times. You were part of the New York Times team of reporters that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for your global coverage on terrorism. Talk about your personal journey, the lessons you were able to draw from it, and then the last part of the question, why you left the New York Times?
Well, I began as a freelance reporter in Central America. I covered the war in El Salvador for 5 years. And as you pointed out, spent 20 years overseas, 15 of them with the New York Times, mostly in conflicts. I was 7 years in the Middle East. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia and Kosovo. I was the Balkan bureau chief for the New York Times. always in places where there was tremendous oppression, often violence, months of my life in Gaza. I'm an Arabic speaker. And that was my career. I came back to the United States and was very vocal in my denunciations of the call to invade Iraq for all of the now obvious reasons. I'd spent, you know, months and months in Iraq. I knew the Middle East. I knew the fiasco that this would engender, not to mention the incredible human cost of these endless wars. And for that, I was eventually booed off of a commencement stage, giving a commencement address, which the trash talk, Fox News, right-wing media picked up, Rush Limbaugh and stuff. And the paper was pressured to respond, and they issued me a formal written reprimand for quote-unquote impugning the impartiality of the New York Times and telling me that I was not allowed to speak out about the war. And that's under, we're guild, so we're union. So you give the employee the reprimand, and then under guild rules, if the employee violates that reprimand, they can be fired. So I left the paper before they fired me because I wasn't going to stop speaking about the war. I'm going to be melodramatic, but I had people I cared about in places like Iraq who I knew would not survive, and indeed they did not, and I felt I had a kind of moral obligation to, especially as an Arabist, especially as somebody who came out of the region, to speak out against what I think is the, probably the greatest strategic blunder in American history.
A lot of European viewers, I'm talking about the general population, do not watch independent media outlets. And for example, one of the leading newspapers called the Süddeutsche Zeitung in Germany has even a cooperation with the New York Times where they publish special editions in cooperation with the New York Times. Talk about the internal workings of the New York Times and also about the general perception, your perception of the mainstream media in Germany and what European viewers should be wary about when they consume the information from corporate media outlets.
Well, having worked for many years for, you know, probably America's premier elitist publication, the New York Times, should, you know, begin by saying that I read the New York Times every day. I listen to the BBC every day. And yet, of course, I'm, as somebody who comes out of that environment, acutely aware of their deficiencies. The New York Times can do and has done good investigative journalism. It remains rooted in verifiable fact, but it also caters to both the financial and the power elites, those on whom they depend for money, i.e. through advertising and access. Access is of primary importance to a publication like the New York Times. And so when I was overseas in places like El Salvador, I wasn't working for the New York Times when I covered the war in Salvador, but this would be a good example. This certainly was in the Middle East. You would write a story off the ground that often contradicted the official narrative coming out of Washington. And the response of a paper like the New York Times is to then interview policymakers and give that their version, which was untrue, let's be honest, equal play, you know, equal length, equal play within the paper. So the readers could believe what they wanted to believe. This was classic. And for those of us, especially who covered conflicts, this was during the Reagan administration in El Salvador, or who were in Israel covering the Israeli atrocities and war crimes against Gaza, the Palestinians in Gaza, this was classic. I mean, one of the tricks that, and tricks is probably the right word, the Times would use when you reported atrocities out of Gaza is every other paragraph getting a response from the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force spokesperson in Jerusalem, even though they weren't in Gaza. And so, you know, Ahmed would be describing how the Israeli soldiers obliterated their house and shot their children when they ran outside, a rather common occurrence in Gaza. And then you'd have a paragraph from the IDF spokesman saying it's completely untrue and it's not verified in Ahmed. And with the kind of racial prejudice, I think we can't underestimate, and I know this because I covered wars such as the wars in Central America or the conflicts in the Middle East. I covered the civil war in the Sudan, Yemen, Algeria. And when people of color are dying, and I noted, I saw this when I got to Yugoslavia because they were white, there's just far more concern on the part of white, primarily white readers in the United States. So the Palestinians were just discredited from the start, and also because of the very fierce and decades-long attempt to vilify and discredit the Palestinian people on the part of Israel, the Israel lobby, and their supporters, primarily in the United States. So, yeah, the Times focuses, this is the number they use, on the top 30 million wage earners in the United States. That's why their lifestyle sections are always about, you know, the struggles of maintaining your second house in the Hamptons, or lifestyles that neither you nor I nor probably anyone watching this show lead. So, yeah, that's it. But we should be clear that the media landscape since I began in the 1980s has degraded tremendously, especially within commercial broadcasting. So you used to have a handful, I don't know what it was like in Germany, of main channels with a very boring middle-of-the-road presenter who was quote-unquote impartial or neutral, which is that is just was a kind of way that they use to give themselves credibility and attract a wider audience. That all broke down with the 24-hour news cable operations and the rise of partisan news outlets like Fox News. So everybody's become partisan. CNN's become partisan. MSNBC becomes partisan. I don't think MSNBC is any better than Fox News. And it's like what Orwell said, your 3 minutes of hate. What they do now is rather than attempt to reach a very broad audience, they focus on a particular segment. If you're watching MSNBC, that's would be a, you know, kind of Democrat with a big D, a Democratic Party. If you're watching Fox or CNN, would be the same. And it's really about selling hate and vitriol, and also turning politics into a kind of sports event. If you look at the way they set up their roundtables, it's their host with three or four commentators who can never come to agreement and always fight over stupid and inane things. It's just like the same thing we do when they do, you know, a football game. It's exactly the same. That looks the same with the scores posted behind this. It's really burlesque and very frightening because it's not news, it's entertainment. And it masks the fact that on almost all the major issues, the two ruling parties in the United States, whether that's trade agreements, imperial war, the security and surveillance apparatus, are in complete and total agreement. What they argue about is what Freud called the narcissism of minor difference. Those are largely cultural issues, which I'm not dismissing them. They're important, but they're not politics. That's kind of anti-politics. So, yeah, the media landscape has deteriorated markedly. I mean, however flawed it was, and it was always flawed when I was covering the wars in Latin America, the major networks all had bureaus and they had producers and camera people and reporters, and they went out and did a 3 to 5 minute piece. Of course, they liked the bang bang stuff, you know, they and it wasn't into nuance or complexity in any way, but at least it was still a form of journalism. That's all vanished. Why is alternative media important? Well, alternative media has always been important because they're freed from commercial restraint. And so they often shame the traditional press into doing their jobs. That's precisely what WikiLeaks did. You know, why did Der Spiegel and The Guardian and The New York Times publish the cables that were courageously released by Chelsea Manning or later the Podesta emails? It's because if they didn't, they knew the alternative press would, and it would expose them for who they are. What they did, of course, as soon as they used that material was turn with a vengeance upon Julian Assange, who's a friend of mine and who I admire immensely, and were complicit in the character assassination that made it possible for the global security state to destroy him and now attempt to extradite him to the United States, where he will be charged under the Espionage Act, which is the equivalent of our British Foreign Secrets Act. It was passed in 1917 by Woodrow Wilson, and it was used to prosecute people who gave classified or secret information to a foreign enemy. Well, Julian Assange is not an American citizen. WikiLeaks is not a U.S.-based publication. It's a complete misuse of the Espionage Act, but is yet one more example of a kind of breakdown of the rule of law, corruption of the rule of law that is endemic now with and used by these global corporate elites. And of course, the whole trial in Belmarsh is farcical. The judge is openly prejudicial, you know, prejudiced against Assange and his defense team, ignoring, I can't remember the 1993 Extradition Act, which prohibits extradition for political offense. I mean, so it's all part of the pretense of the rule of law, which gets into a whole other issue. I mean, the breakdown of the rule of law, which is quite extreme now within the United States.
This is the journalist, author, TV host, and charismatic public speaker, Chris Hedges. This interview by Zan Raza took place on May 5, 2020, on Activism Munich in Germany.
A lot of European viewers are watching the U.S. election very closely because what is decided in the U.S., whether it's NATO policies towards nuclear-armed states such as Russia or whether it's escalating with Iran, and we saw how the U.S.'s invasion in Iraq created the basis for the refugee crisis, which gave a lot of fuel to the fire, to the far right. And even things like the United States pressuring other countries such as Germany to increase their military spending, all of this affects, all of the actions of the U.S. affects European countries. So with that context, which candidate do you think, Trump or Biden, will be more favorable if they come into power towards European perspective?
The whole project of open hostility with Russia is a Democratic Party project. For two reasons, although Trump, despite his rhetoric, hasn't been very good towards Russia. And that's because U.S. policy towards Russia is driven by the arms industry. Remember that after the fall of the Berlin Wall, I was there, actually. I was in Berlin. I was in staying in the Schweizerhof. I was there 2 weeks before the wall fell. So I was in Leipzig every day and then went on and did the revolutions in Czechoslovakia and Romania. But so after the wall fell, there was a promise made to Gorbachev that NATO would not extend beyond a unified Germany. Well, there were gigantic arms markets in Eastern Europe that if those countries became part of NATO would make and are making billions and billions of dollars to reconfigure those militaries into NATO, make them NATO compatible. And that's precisely what's happened all the way up to Russia's border. And then you have the demonization of Russia is used by the Democratic Party as a way not to address or accept their own responsibility for the deindustrialization and offshoring of jobs that have hollowed the United States out from the inside, turned most of our cities into industrial wastelands, thrust hundreds of thousands of people out of work. That was a Democratic Party. It was a bipartisan project, but very actively a Democratic Party project. And so Russia is used also, you know, this absurd idea that Russia stole the election is a way for the Democratic Party. And Biden was one of the major architects of all this, including the mass incarceration. We have 25% of the world's prison population. We are 5% of the world's population. Almost all these people are poor people of color from these deindustrialized urban areas, what Malcolm X called our internal colonies. And it is really lethal, police terror, and I don't use that word lightly, coupled with mass incarceration that is the primary form of social control. All this, the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill, all this came with Biden and Clinton. Biden used to go around bragging about how he had expanded the death penalty crimes from a handful to, I think, 50. I think they're up to 90 now. So the policies towards Russia will become more aggressive under the Democrats, ironically, than Trump. Although the actual mechanics of what's happening vis-a-vis Russia won't change dramatically because that's not being run by Trump. That's being run by the defense contractors who actually set the policy vis-a-vis NATO.
There's a huge debate taking place on the left. Even European viewers are watching this. And it's between voting for Joe Biden or voting for Donald Trump, who is the lesser evil. For example, Noam Chomsky has repeatedly stated that big, small differences in huge power can have large effects. And with that, I'm trying to say that he thinks that Joe Biden is the lesser evil because there is more channels available to the public to influence policy under a Biden presidency. Biden signed the Iran deal, which under Obama, and even things like that Trump did was not done under the Obama administration, which includes the arms treaty INF, which was signed to limit nuclear weapons with the ranges of 500 to 5,500 kilometers. And we also saw the complete dissolution and abolition of the climate change treaty. How do you see this? Do you think that Biden, given this track record that I mentioned, is a better president than Donald Trump, or do you view them as being part of the same coin?
Look, the ruling elites made it very clear during the election, and there were a series of articles in the New York Times where they stated this, that if primarily Sanders, but Warren or Sanders, but primarily Sanders was the Democratic Party nominee, they would vote for Donald Trump. This whole notion of the least worst only applies to us, not to them. They ensure that whatever candidate is in there, Trump, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, protects the interests of the global oligarchic elites and corporate power. Of course, they prefer Biden, just as they preferred Clinton. Trump is patently inept and a narcissist and, you know, an embarrassment to the empire. But they know full well that the maintenance of empire will be carried out whether it is Trump or Biden. I, of course, Noam Chomsky is, and I know Noam and like Noam very much. He is our most important intellectual, but he has for, you know, always repeated this mantra of voting for the least worst. In fact, what that has done in terms of those of us who care about an open society and equality and racial justice has rendered or neutered our effectiveness, because the Democratic Party knows full well that it doesn't matter what they do. We will comply. We will surrender whatever values we have. You know, the whole anti-war movement, which I was part of, collapsed once Kerry was the Democratic nominee, because we had to get Kerry elected. And so if you don't put pit power against power, if you don't put pressures on the center of power, you just move irrevocably further and further to the right. I mean, the Democratic Party in Europe would be considered a far right party. And this is the problem, that I think that the Democratic Party, or those who care about the working class within the Democratic Party, should have walked out of the party when Bill Clinton signed NAFTA in 1994, which was the greatest betrayal of the American working class since the passage of the 1948 Taft-Hartley Act. So we didn't. We didn't stand with the working class. We betrayed the working class. We busied ourselves with kind of boutique activism, inclusiveness, and multiculturalism. I'm not denying that that's all important. It is important that people have rights, whether that's gender rights or anything else. But you can't divorce that from economic justice. And so now you have given rise to these proto-fascist forces gathering around Trump, largely comprised of a betrayed white working class. And they have been betrayed. And their vitriol is especially fierce towards the Democratic Party, which traditionally had at least taken into account their interests. And so that's the problem. So if you look at it in the short term, would Biden be better than Trump? Yeah. But the fact is, the mess we've gotten into is because progressives and the left didn't stand with the working class as it was being decimated. And that working class found its voice in a demagogue like Trump. And that isn't going to change. I mean, Trump is the symptom. Trump is not the disease. I saw that in the former Yugoslavia when we vomited up these figures like Radovan Karadzic and Slobodan Milosevic and Franjo Tuđman. That's what happens when society seizes up and a cabal takes power. You can go back and look at Weimar. Exactly the same kind of situation. I'm not saying that Trump is Hitler or the Nazis. That's not. But there are lessons to be learned from a dysfunctional, decayed society. And everybody forgets, which is also true in the United States, that the erosion of the rule of law in Germany was carried out by Ebert because of the negative majorities within the Reichstag, the inability to function. The legislative process didn't function. Ebert had decree after decree after decree. Well, this also happened in the United States. And of course, it's what the Nazis used to consolidate power, but they weren't the first to use it. It had been normalized. So the problem is that the political system no longer functions. It's dominated by corporate money. The legislation is written by corporate lobbyists, including the latest quote-unquote stimulus package was directed and written by corporate lobbyists. And the whole consent of the governed is a joke. Politicians need such massive amounts of money in order to run and stay in office. Where are they going to get it? It's just a form of legalized bribery. And so the danger, and I know Noam is not doing this, but the danger with reducing it to who do you vote for is to personalize a dysfunctional political system. And I, you know, I have two disagreements with Noam, and one is on this mantra of the least worst, which just frankly hasn't worked. And of course, I'm a strong supporter of the BDS movement, which he is not. But otherwise, I admire him immensely.
That was Chris Hedges, interviewed by Zan Rasa on May 5, 2020, on Activism Munich in Germany. A video of the 45-minute conversation under the title Chris Hedges on Biden versus Trump is posted on the Activism Munich YouTube channel. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a New York Times best-selling author, a professor at Rutgers University, and an ordained Presbyterian minister. He has written 12 books, including the best-selling American Fascist, The Christian Right and the War on America. His latest book is America, the Farewell Tour. And as you just heard in this interview, he's working on a new book due out in November. Come back for the conclusion of this conversation when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website. TUCRadio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gloden. Thank you for listening.